One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, January 13th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the award-winning, three times in a row, The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live. In the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's a Matt and Mike, Matt and Michael Monday, the first of 2014. On today's show, talking with Daniel Levy, the European Council on Foreign Relations, former Israeli peace negotiator, on what the actual legacy of Ariel Sharon is, plus a lot more on Chris Christie.
A lot more on Chris Christie. Things aren't looking so good for our pal over in New Jersey.
Things are not looking so good for Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough's actual pal, Chris Christie.
Things aren't looking so good for Wall Street-type Republicans who are hoping he'd be their man for 2016.
Things aren't looking so good for just generally horrible, narcissistic, obnoxious people who use public office for their old ends. Well, maybe that's an overstatement, but at least one specific obnoxious narcissist things aren't looking too good for. More on Roger Ailes, the Fox News chief. It's amazing, this book. Yeah, it's amazing. You know what I love about this book is that you know when an unauthorized Ailes biography is going to come out. You can kind of fill in the details. You know that he's going to be a right-wing extremist. You know that he's going to be nasty to people and rude and unethical. But when a book comes out and you already know all of that stuff and the book somehow still manages to surprise you, that's pretty impressive. And this Ailes thing,
because it's all in the details.
It's all in the
and
details.
And man, are these details.
Those are some details, folks. Also, obviously, we're monitoring and we'll have more coverage this week. The disaster in West Virginia. The spill from Freedom Industries. Freedom Industries that's poisoning the state, and lack of monitoring of that situation since I think the 90s, which led up to this.
I think libertarians look around and they said, you know what? I don't see any states with massive chemically toxic water sitting around, right? Like a mass amount of it. It's not fair for people in this country who want the freedom,
right,
to drink this toxic water,
or the freedom to not be able to drink or make baby formula.
And thanks to the great people, the great politicians of West Virginia and their views on regulations,
and the great
West Virginia
corporations.
And the corporations, of course,
that own the state.
West Virginia was the perfect place to bring this lack of chemically toxic water to America for people who want that freedom to drink it.
That's right. And obviously any check on that freedom is the first step on the road to tyranny. Also, over the weekend was the fourth anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti. We'll get back to that later, I'm sure, as well. But we just kind of want to acknowledge that date, too. The Golden Globes were yesterday. I don't have anything to add to that one. I don't know. Did you watch that?
I did. I thought it was, I don't know why we're talking about it right now.
I don't know.
We'll talk about it in the better half.
Golden Globes, obviously important time in football. All right, folks, we'll be right back with Daniel Levy on the European Council of Foreign Relations. We're talking the Ariel Sharon legacy. We'll be right back.
Freedom of jail clips inserted. A baby's being born, same time a man is murdered. The beginning and end. As far as rap goes, it's only natural. I explain my plateau and also what defines my name. First it was nasty, but times have changed. Ask me now, I'm the artist, but hardcore, my signs for pain. I spent time in the game, kept my mind on fame. Saw things shoot up and do lines of saw my close friend shot, flatline of my same. That depends, carry Mac-10s to practice my aim. On rooftops, tape CD covers the trees. Line a barrel up with your weak picture then squeeze. Street scriptures for lost souls in the crossroads. To the corner thugs hustling for cars that cost dough. To the big dogs living large, taking it light. Pushing big toys, getting nice, join your life is what you make it. Suicide, few tried to take it. Belt tied around their neck and jail cells naked. Heaven and hell, rap legend, presence is felt. And of course, NAS are the letters that spell.
Not like life or death. Fuck my rap. My poetry's deep, I never felt. Not like half man, half amazing. No doubt. Not like life or death. Fuck my rap. My poetry's deep, I never felt. Not like half man, half amazing. No doubt. Not like
earth, wind, and fire. Rims and tires. Bulletproof glass inside is the realest driver. Planets in orbit. Line them up with the stars, tarot cards, you can see the Pharaoh Nas. Iron Mike, Messiah type, before the Christ, after the death, the last one left. Let my cash invest in stock, came a long way from blasting, text on blocks, went from Seiko to Rolex, owning acres from the project.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
And I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Daniel Levy. He is the Middle East Director at the European Council on Foreign Relations and a former peace negotiator for the Israeli government. Daniel, how are you?
Yes. Could you
Sorry. It was perfect. Daniel, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Doing well. Very, very glad to have you on. So we want to talk about the full Sharon legacy, I guess. He's been obviously being covered very favorably, and there's a certain narrative that's forming around him as a kind of warrior who turned to peace, which a lot of people, including myself, question. But let's kind of set the frame for this conversation. Over the weekend, or just yesterday, in fact, was his funeral in Jerusalem. And I want to read you a quote from Vice President Biden. He said, this is what he said at Sharon's eulogizing Ariel Sharon yesterday. Quote, like all historic leaders, all real leaders, he had a North Star that guided him. His North Star was the survival of the State of Israel and the Jewish people wherever they resided. I was wondering, I guess the question I would have for you is, I think that what was that conception of the State of Israel that Sharon had? What was his specific brand or flavor of that commitment, of his North Star?
Yeah, it's a fascinating point, and I think it was actually a very mainstream classic Israeli nationalist perception of Israel and Israel's role. And in that respect, I don't think Sharon was this figure who oscillated wildly from the far right of Israeli politics to the left of Israeli politics and became a big peacenik. I think that the leading figures, himself perhaps at the forefront of his generation, saw the Israeli-Palestinian issue, conflict, in zero-sum terms. And even when Sharon was withdrawing from Gaza, people are attributing it to it now, a step as part of some kind of peace effort. He didn't describe it those ways and didn't see it in those ways. And so I think for Sharon, this was about Jewish survival. And what's strange about that Biden comment, of course, is that it would be like saying an American leader, in a way it would be like saying this, an American leader's guiding star was how to protect white Christian America.
Right.
I think therein lies the problem, the issue, the challenge here. Sharon Sharon did see things through this prism, which I don't think could get beyond survival. And I think for Israel in the 21st century, for Israel in 2014 or in 2001 to 2006, Israel had been established. Israel's a nuclear power. Israel has the patronage of the world's only superpower. There came a time in Israel's history where it should have been about, and we're still in that time because we're not there yet, when Israel's leaders should have been about what kind of an Israel. What does it mean to be a democracy with a large non-Jewish Palestinian minority? What does it mean to live in this neighborhood? How are we going to come to terms with all of those things? And it still never reached that point. But that was a failing of Labor Zionism, mm-hmm, as much as it was a failing of rightist Likud Jabotinskyite Zionism. And in that respect, it's hardly surprising, I think, that Sharon ended his career in a political party together with Shimon Peres.
Right. He went on to found Kadima, which is, you know, is often portrayed in the West as a centrist party. And I guess in the sense that you're saying it, maybe it was in the center of Israeli opinion, but that's a pretty right-wing view in a kind of broader sense. When, you know, I guess taking it back to, and maybe we can sort of run backwards these different very controversial moments in his career that I think reveal and speak very directly to the frame that you just set around it. He also, what was his role in kind of facilitating the Second Intifada and sort of undermining peace negotiations after they had collapsed between Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat, which was what directly led to his becoming prime minister in the first place?
Yeah, we're referring, of course, to the incidents of the 28th of September 2000. Mm-hmm. And Ariel Sharon, as a premeditated, provocative act, decides that he's going to go on to the temple mount with a massive to the third holiest site in Islam, to the area that Israel, since Israel has controlled this area, has said this is for the Muslim Islamic authorities, the Waqf, to oversee, to supervise. We're not going to assert our sovereignty here. This is where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is. So, and Sharon wanted to make a demonstration of presence at that place at a tense moment, surrounded, of course, by Israeli security, a massive Israeli security presence. There were warnings in advance by the professional policing and security echelons in Israel that this was liable to unleash a possible counter-reaction and wave of violence. By the way, Prime Minister Ehud Barak, it was within his purview to prevent it. He didn't.
Right.
And it's also one of these peculiarities of how terribly minor events can have massive repercussions. And the thing that I recall from that event is that in some exchanges of stone throwing and some riot dispersal shooting that took place from the Israeli side in response to the stone throwing, the head of Jerusalem police at the time, who I think would have been a calming influence, was hit by a stone. His police saw that happen. He was no longer in control of the situation, and things spiraled out of control. The way in which the Second Intifada unfolded until he became prime minister, which was a few months, you can't attribute all of that to Ariel Sharon or blame Ariel Sharon. What you can say about the Second Intifada is, and this has been documented since, especially in an important documentary called 1 Million Case Shells, casing shells of gun ordnance, of bullets, that Israel was ready with a massive disproportionate response to this outbreak of what began with popular Palestinian violence. It, of course, descended into what became a very ugly tit for tat of terror attacks on the Palestinian side, of assassinations and closures and sieges imposed on the Palestinian public. And clearly Sharon was not beyond doing things that were liable to provoke.
Yeah. And in a sense, it validated his narrative of the peace process being fraudulent and the peace process not working. You had this kind of collapse of talks. He went and took this very provocative visit. And then in conjunction with the other things you mentioned, that sort of fed the narrative that, you know, there isn't a partner for peace. This isn't a tenable project. And then that kind of facilitated his leadership.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, one again, I think we would be misreading Sharon and by extension misreading Israel and not enhancing our understanding of Israel if one were to single him out too much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he was the classic Israeli nationalist leader on steroids sometimes. But remember, it was Ehud Barak who first turned round and blamed the Palestinians and said there was no partner.
Right.
After Camp David. And in a way, Barak really paved the way for the Sharon premiership. I don't think Sharon was a leader who broke the mold. And I know that there is an understandable sense in which he was a game-changing leader because of the withdrawal from Gaza. And while I don't want to make light of the significance of that withdrawal, I also think it can be overhyped the other way. I say that because I think the school of thought which he came from, which what I'm arguing is that it was shared by much of Labour and Likud Zionism, was you keep as much as you can, you expand as much as you can, but sometimes you have to tactically retreat, because it was about doing what was politically, diplomatically, militarily possible. I would almost argue that that's the difference between Sharon and some of the current crop of Likud leaders and government ministers and government coalition members from this party that people may have heard of called the Jewish Home, this guy Naftali Bennett, but also from inside Netanyahu's party, and also perhaps Netanyahu himself, is that they are not cognizant of the limitations. Now, I think the project that he was trying to promote, even within those limitations, was not good for Israel's security, let alone well-being, prosperity, sense of self-esteem as a democratic society in the region. But nonetheless, it was a project that knew limitations. And so it was possible in the context of that project to do something like withdraw from Gaza. And he withdrew from Gaza. It was a dramatic act. I think sometimes it was intentionally made into a bigger drama than it had to be. But remember, this is 8,000 people withdrawn from Gaza. Gaza is a tiny sliver of territory. If there were ever a Palestinian state on what we call the 67 lines, on 22% of Greater Israel, Greater Palestine, the mandate, the former British mandate, if that were ever the case, Gaza would only be 6% of that land. And by withdrawing from Gaza, Sharon added thousands, tens of thousands of settlers, or subsequently tens of thousands of settlers have been added in the West Bank. It made it easier for him to entrench the hold on the West Bank and East Jerusalem. He did make a minor withdrawal from four small settlements on the West Bank. But I think it was always about maximizing what you could do. And again, it was about unilateralism. It was about the Palestinians not being partners in determining their fate. So I think things like reconciliation, partnership, empathy, those things were an anathema to Sharon.
Yeah.
What was not an anathema to Sharon was that sometimes you had to, as I said, strategically retreat. Sometimes you had to realize the limits of how far you could push the envelope. And I think in that respect, in the context of today's Israeli leadership, I can understand why people would say, wow, you know, that's something right. to cling on to.
Right.
One other caveat that is perhaps not an insignificant caveat to this. and I think Sharon had to be conscious of it, by setting that precedent of withdrawal from settlements, Sharon has made it easier for any future Israeli leader to say, well, the great warrior, the man, the beloved leader Sharon, he did this. So support me, Israeli public, as I withdraw settlements from A, B, C, D.
Right. So, and I think it's also just, and I want to kind of get to some other points in Sharon's career that probably that need to be highlighted more than they are being highlighted in most press accounts right now. But I think it's also important to say, right in line with your assessment of the withdrawal from Gaza, that that didn't. It also, you know, Israel is still functionally in control of Gaza. You know, the what commerce goes into Gaza, what types of aid, what types of supplies. Egypt is also controlling of the other side of Gaza. Now, obviously, Hamas is in control of Gaza, and there's maybe some there are some legitimate security questions there. But it's not as if even that withdrawal had any type of real kind of sustainable implications for Gaza really building itself in a certain way, let alone the broader return or creation of a Palestinian state on 67 borders. And it's interesting because in some ways what it sort of reminds me of, as you articulate it, in contrasting Sharon and Netanyahu, and maybe even, as you say, the kind of labor tradition as well, but particularly Sharon and Netanyahu, it's almost like sometimes you'll read accounts of negotiations in 2011 between President Obama and the House Republicans. And at times, if you're, you know, if you have a progressive perspective, Obama is offering just these horrible, horrible deals, you know, serious cuts, you know, seriously austerity, draconian spending cuts. And Boehner, a guy like that, that's 80% of what he wants. He would want to take it. And then, you know, the Tea Party people are screaming and they're you know, themselves till they're hoarse and refusing absolutely anything. And then all of a sudden in the narratives, you know, guys like, you know, even Boehner to a degree, who are incredibly conservative, they start saying, well, you know, he's the kind of business-like Republican because he's willing to take 80% of the loaf and not kind of demand 100%. And that seems the contrast between Sharon and Netanyahu that you're outlining.
Absolutely. It's nice to hear you say that. It's actually an analogy I use myself because I think that's absolutely right. And I think this is the first thing Sharon would say to the settlers is, we didn't get where we are today, 45 plus years into the occupation, 600,000 Israelis living beyond the green line, by shouting from the rooftops that this is what we intend to do and it's ours forever and no compromise. No, we did it by building the hilltops and telling everyone that we wanted peace while doing everything that was antithetical to that at the same time. And I think it's, you know, as you say, I think the lesson that some Republicans are now trying to teach the Tea Party is, listen, we've managed to create a situation in which public spending to promote employment, education, health is almost ruled out in most respectable so-called American policy circles. We've managed to make small government by debt reduction, by pushing back against any public works programs, almost a consensus. Don't ruin it.
Right.
And I think that is the debate on that is the success of what I call this misplaced Israeli maximalist nationalist consensus. And of course, part of it is to always rhetorically articulate your support for peace while doing the exact opposite. In Gaza, which was what you actually introduced as a subject, the situation post-withdrawal. I am not going to defend, because I think it's indefensible, the launching of rocket fire on innocent civilian population centers. That's a war crime, and those who launch those rockets should be called on it. What I'm also not going to give credence to is this idea that the conditions have been created by the withdrawal for Gaza to flourish and become a new Singapore and become this model of what Palestine would be, and the Palestinians screwed it. I mean, come on, this is one of the most densely concentrated population centers in the world, a tiny sliver of land. The vast majority of people are living in refugee camps. Their access to the world is closed off. Israel prevents them from building a seaport. Gaza is on the coast. Israel prevents them from having an airport. Everything has to come through Israel or Egypt, and Egypt is culpable here as well, and one mustn't let them off the hook.
Definitely.
There are draconian restrictions imposed on that. Israel still controls the entire sea, air, and land envelope, plus there's the land envelopes controlled by Egypt. So these, what you had were laboratory conditions for a nightmare, yes, not laboratory conditions for a flourishing Gaza. And I think there was something cynically, calculatedly malicious about the way in which this was done. Like I said, I think the Palestinians could have managed the situation better, but let's also bear this in mind. 6% of the landmass of, if you accept two states as a Palestinian, 6% of the landmass had just been liberated. 94% of the landmass was still under occupation, and an occupation that was making itself more entrenched, locked, yes. Was it conceivable that that 6% would be used as a base from which to launch attacks against the occupier? Was it predictable? I think it was. And I think doing the withdrawal outside of the context of an agreement, outside of the context of a partnership, outside of the context of a broader peace deal, I think one doesn't have to be a conspiracy theorist to say there was at least an element of premeditated thinking that said this isn't going to reflect badly on the Palestinians ultimately, and be yet another useful PR message toolbox device for Israel. And of course, that's how it's played out, because the narrative that you hear time and time again is, well, we can't do that. Look what happened when we gave them Gaza. And it's incredibly effective. And it's had a devastating impact in the internal Israeli debate, partly because there is not a strong enough progressive camp in Israel to push back against that, unfortunately.
Absolutely. Now, I think it is really, really important to just to note this, to go back earlier in Sharon's career, because, you know, this is his role in Lebanon, specifically Sabra and Shatila. I'll have you explain what actually took place with these massacres of Palestinian refugees that, you know, many think Sharon was certainly at least indirectly complicit in. And I think that it was these incidents in Lebanon that I think even amongst, especially when Sharon first came to power, the kind of just even mainstream kind of liberal global circles, at least, less so in the United States because there's such a one-dimensional debate about Israel here. But that was something that really kind of caught a lot of people about Sharon, that there was a level of kind of personal and direct culpability in tremendous human rights abuses that really kind of went very directly to him. So I guess taking these incidents as the examples of that, there are more, but these are probably the most important to highlight. What was the context for what happened there? What happened and how do you kind of explain it? And what should we know about his role in these things as we reflect on his legacy?
Look, it's known that Sharon perhaps more effectively than most Israeli leaders had an understanding, or his understanding was that, I mentioned before, zero sum between the Israeli national movement and the Palestinian national movement. Mm-hmm. And the Palestinian national movement had to be kept vanquished or emaciated or as in a box as possible. And at the time, the Palestinians had, some people called it a state within a state. The Palestinian presence after the leadership, the armed groups were expelled from Jordan, had moved over to Lebanon. Lebanon was somewhere where many of the expelled Palestinians from 1947 to 49 had found refuge. There were large refugee camps of Palestinians in Lebanon. So you have this PLO, Palestinian presence. It's Arafat's headquarters. And the armed groups operate out of Lebanon. there was an attack on the then Israeli ambassador here, where I am in London, Shlomo Argov. That attack was not conducted by the PLO. I'm pretty sure that the Israeli military leadership at the time knew that it was conducted by a splinter Palestinian faction. But that was the pretense for Sharon to launch what was his second campaign in Lebanon, or what was Israel's second campaign in Lebanon. There had been a mini invasion in 1978. Lebanon is, of course, still in the throes of a civil war. And the idea was that Israel could tip the balance of that internal Lebanese civil war and have its proxy, its friends, people who were willing to do business with Israel in power in Lebanon, and that the PLO could be dealt a severe blow, and Arafat personally dealt a severe blow. Sharon misleads the Israeli government. He claims that there is a limited mission going on in Lebanon in response to the attempted assassination of Argov in London. The mission goes all the way to the suburbs of Beirut before the Israeli government really catches up with things. Begin, Menachem Begin, was the prime minister at the time. Many people have looked on this deceit by Sharon of Begin as a turning moment for Begin's premiership and for his own actual mental health well-being. The Israeli forces surround the major Palestinian refugee camp in Beirut, Sabra and Shatila, and Israel's ally, the Christian Falangist Militia, a proto-fascist organization, is allowed to go in to the camp with the pretty clear understanding that what would result would not be pleasant for the Palestinians, and what results is terribly unpleasant and is a massacre of the Palestinian population in Sabra and Shatila. To Israel's credit, there is an outpouring of anger. There is what is considered to be the largest demonstration. The number given is 400,000 Israelis, which at the time was 10% plus of the Israeli population. It almost certainly wasn't 400,000. Nevertheless, it was a massive outpouring. And I give Israelis real credit for that. And the government set up a commission of inquiry, the Kahan Commission. And that found, as you said, Ariel Sharon, then Minister of Defense, indirectly responsible. And he had to resign. The great irony was that someone who could not be Israel's defense minister comes back as its prime minister. Of course, you know, the ability of an Israel to micromanage Lebanese political affairs, a bit like the ability of America to micromanage Afghanistan or Iraqi political affairs, was proven to be somewhat of an illusion. Israel's allies don't come to power. And one of the, I imagine, unintended consequences is that as Israel maintains its presence and occupation in southern Lebanon, the Hezbollah movement is formed. Right. So there were many kind of consequences of what Sharon did in Lebanon. But I think that a consequence that you just pointed out, which was what this did to the image of Israel. I was a student on campus a few years after when Israel was still in southern Lebanon, but a few years after the Sabra and Shatila, and the extent to which, certainly in a British campus, that coloured and shaped opinion of Israel. And I think it was a moment of dramatic overreach for Israel, and I think again it was one of those moments that could Israel turn a corner. And unfortunately not.
Yeah, as a final question, and I'm definitely expecting a certain answer, but I wonder if there's any hope here. is when you no, but I think that's fascinating, because you know there's obviously Max Blumenthal has this new book out, and there's a lot of kind of writing on you know, obviously the broader history of Israel, and then there's and domestic politics in Israel. But it's fascinating and very striking, as you say, that yes, at the same moment that this guy who later became prime minister basically, you know, at the very least played a significant role in what you just, I mean, it really was just a horrific Sabra and Shatila, men, women, you know, children, really brutal, you know, extermination almost in these camps. but at the same time, as you say, there was this massive outpouring in Israel, and there was a sense both of genuine outrage against what had happened and also obviously a among other people, as you say, a canny perception of how that image – of how that would affect the image of Israel and the rest of the world. As we look today and, you know, we're kind of looking at the – you know, Biden is there, this kind of full, you know, very, very nice kind of easy obituaries in the New York Times and other places of Sharon. I mean, is there still that block of people in Israel that would be significant enough to – you know, shift the debate or frame the debate that would go out and demonstrate against something like Shabra and Shatila today? Or is that kind of progressive humanitarian impulse really marginalized in contemporary Israeli politics?
Look, first of all, it's still there. And, you know, I would bemoan that it is not larger. I think there's a lot to bemoan in that respect. The project of creating a liberal Israeli movement constituency, given the circumstances in which Israel finds itself, not all of Israel's making, given the ease with which Israeli political leaders can draw on the horrors of recent Jewish history. Yes. And use scaremongering, if you imagine how easy that was in the United States after 9/11, you know, multiply that by many factors and right. Imagine how easy that is. Even today in Israel, it meant it was going to be a challenging project. But now, if you add to that, there were visionary or far-sighted Israelis who understood this immediately in 67. If you add to that what it does to a society to manage an occupation for over four decades, of course, it goes without saying what that does to Palestinian society to live under occupation, but also what it does to the society that is the occupying power, that is sending its 18-year-old kids to be occupiers of another people whose freedoms and basic rights and democracy they are denying, that has terribly corrosive effects on the moral well-being of a society. Which, you stack all that together, these are hard circumstances in which to build a progressive Israel. That flame still exists. I think the one of the challenges is going to be to make that more effective cross-communal between the 20% of Israelis who are Palestinian citizens of Israel and the progressive Jewish Israeli community. I think there has been a failure to do that more. And I think there has also been a failure from the outside. And I think probably, you know, in our conversation, this is an appropriate place to end. Indulging in American indulgence of undemocratic, illiberal, inhumane Israeli practices. This idea that we're an ally because we share values. Yeah, those values are shared by some Israelis, but those aren't the values that Israeli policy pursues. And of course, those aren't values that America is always held.
Right, I was going to say, maybe we do share some values that are not so great, right?
And the idea that even progressive America gives Israel a pass on so many of these things far too often, I think that has been a huge disservice to Israel and definitely a huge disservice to progressive Israel. And those alliances need to be built as well. And I don't think there is, you know, there are fantastic Israeli civil society initiatives. There's the New Israel Fund, which is an umbrella under which many of them exist. And progressive Americans and American Jews should be taking a much closer and more critical look at what goes on and being allies to a democratic progressive Israel rather than to this idea that Israel can do no wrong, which really is a great disservice to Israel. But it's been a pleasure talking to you, Michael.
Oh, thank you so much, Daniel. It's excellent having you on. Daniel Levy, Middle East Director at the European Council on Foreign Relations and an essential voice on all of this. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Bye-bye. Well, there you go, folks. I think important corrective for a lot of the kind of mainstream droning that you'll be hearing over, hearing about Ariel Sharon and already have heard over the past couple of days. I remember the first times I read about Sabra and Shatila, and, you know, I never had a particularly strong, you know, I have Jewish background. I wasn't particularly identified with that issue one way or another, other than certainly having some generic sense of a need for two states and a need to end the occupation. But I remember, I forget how old I was. It was, you know, pretty young when Sharon was coming up, and I read about Sabra and Shatila, and that really, it just put a different context for understanding the whole thing and who had access to power in some ways, and obviously gotten more educated since. But that those are the essential things to look at for a full accounting of the guy's legacy. What do you think, man? Do we have time to do a few more stories, or what do we
going,
do here?
We're
going
to go to the better half.
Okay.
Where we will, well, the fun half.
The fun
as
half.
Sam likes to call it.
Now it is now officially christened
yes,
the fun half.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. So become a member today. And along with that wonderful interview with Daniel Levy on the legacy of Ariel Sharon, you'll get some, I guess, funner stories that
well,
may be a little bit on the lighter
who's
end.
Who's
going to
give
things?
You the best perspective on Chris Christie?
Exactly.
Obviously, the Majority Report.
Exactly.
Obviously. Who's going to give you the Roger Ailes perspective the best? Us.
We got some great sound from Bill O'Reilly
and
Britt Hume.
Yes.
And join us in the better half of the program. Become a member today at majority.fm. You can also support this show by buying your junk through Amazon. You can just go to the website, majorityreportkickback.com. And that will take you right to our Amazon link, where everything you buy, we get a little bit in return from Amazon. You see no difference in the cost of your junk. We just get a little bit from Amazon.
It's great.
You could also support this show by downloading our app at majorityapp.com. You could also support this show, as I keep saying, you could also support this show by subscribing to us on YouTube at youtube.com/Sam Cedar. Following us on Twitter at MajorityFM. Liking us on Facebook at facebook.com/MajorityReport.
Yeah, we want to get our Facebook likes up there. And you know, I just really quick with the app.
Donate your account at
donateyouraccount.com. And every time, and I've definitely heard from people who now they listen to the show pretty regularly because of the app. So if you're already a fan and you know how great this show is and how – you know, I think legitimately in some ways that it like this, the show plays an important role in media and in the conversation to a degree. Tell your friends about the app and tune them into the show that way, because it really, you know, people now it's like they can listen to it whether they're taking a run or out doing errands or whatever. So thanks so much. If you want to join the show and call in, it is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920.
You can also IM us through the app.
Yeah, IM us through the app. We'll get to it all in the fun half of the show. We'll be right back.